For the week of October 16th, 2011, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 123, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York, I'm Michael Giltz.
How is New York these days, Michael?
It's great, Sperling. It's great to hear from you. Have you downloaded any new free apps lately?
Well, no, because up until, I guess, Thursday or Friday of last week, I didn't have access to the internet, at least not mobile access to the internet, or even, in fact, my emails or any of the text messages you sent me.
I know, you have a BlackBerry. God bless them.
Yes, I also use, to write, I use a slate and a hammer and chisel.
And my roommate, my friend, actually, I shouldn't say roommate, also has a BlackBerry, and he hadn't been receiving messages in days and couldn't quite figure out why. And then suddenly I saw this worldwide alert, and then I realized I hadn't heard from you in days. But BlackBerry's made it all better. They're going to let you download some free apps like Bejeweled, Texas Hold'em Poker 2, Bubble Bash 2, Photo Editor Ultimate. So, you know, I'm sure that has made you perfectly happy.
Yeah, I think that kind of underscores that decision right there. Totally underscores why it is RIM, Research in Motion, is completely imploding.
Are they completely imploding? Don't they still have a huge base of users?
Yes, but their shareholders are trying to force the company into, you know, to sell the company or to get rid of the co-CEOs. This was just a, talk about the worst week to have a BlackBerry outage. It would probably be the week that the iPhone 4S comes out a week or two after Steve Jobs passes away.
Yeah, and they've sold 4 million units of the iPhone 4S, which, you know, for about an hour, people were saying, what a disaster. It's boring. It's nothing. And yet, of course, it's the best seller yet. And BlackBerry, beyond offering all those free apps, said, hey, we'll also offer a free month of tech service. It's like, well, gee, shouldn't you be offering that anyway if your phone isn't working at all?
Yeah, that's a good point. I didn't know that it wasn't working for like a day until I somehow logged onto the internet and saw that there was a BlackBerry outage. And then when I finally got reconnected, you sent me a text message, which I couldn't decipher. But it was a text message that said, and I'm paraphrasing here, that you felt that Yahoo and its directory of internet links by subject was antiquated, and that you had a great idea for a new service and a new website that would allow people to search in almost in real time for the websites they're interested in. In fact, you were going to call it Goggle.
Well, you kept saying how you didn't know how long when you'd received this email or when it was sent or how old it was, and you hoped it hadn't been delayed too long and that you had just seen it now. So I just sent you an email from 1995.
Yes, I thought that was very funny. It took me like about an hour to understand, oh, wait a second. He's trying to pretend that this was sent back in 1995, and I'm just kidding. I get it.
So I had Comic-Con this weekend in New York, about 90,000 people heading to the Javits Center to dress up as superheroes, see lots of panels about things like the 20th anniversary of Bone or new episodes of The Walking Dead, all their favorite comic book, graphic novel, movie, and TV show, you know, geeky stuff.
And what did you go dressed as? That's really the most important part of that whole story.
I went dressed as a mild-mannered newspaper reporter. I was in disguise.
That must have taken hours to put together that costume.
That's right. And the New York Film Festival is winding up, and so that's over with. So it's also the end of the New York Musical Theater Festival. I've seen about 12 or 13 new musicals in the last 2.5 weeks, so it's been a busy month.
Well, I know we're going to be talking about theater a little later on in the show, but did you get to see Hugo, the new Martin Scorsese film? I guess it's a work in progress. It was shown at the New York Film Festival as a work in progress, so it's not done yet. But it's receiving a lot of praise for its artistic use of 3D, a technique often derided as gimmickry, according to the New York Times.
Was it like the full film, a la like they did with Beauty and the Beast and some of that other stuff?
I don't know. It seems like it was the full film. It received a lot of positive word of mouth, and they're calling it a film that is kind of a love letter to the history of cinema.
Well, I saw the trailer in the theaters and thought it looked god-awful. That's all I know. I didn't see whatever they showed at the New York Film Festival. The trailer looked dreadful, dreadful. So that's all I know.
You know what else is getting good reviews? Or I guess, yeah, you could say they're good reviews, is Tintin.
Yes, Tintin got pretty good reviews. I wouldn't call them raves, but they said it was pure fun, family film, seems geared towards kiddies. But it was screened in London, I guess, before it opened, and it got good reviews, and Variety and Hollywood Reporter both weighed in. They both seem to think it's very commercial, though there's little things in the reviews. They're industry people. They all seem to want it to succeed, but there's little hints like
that
saying
it might not be as good as you'd hoped it would be.
Well, they say stuff like Jamie Bell, who's a terrific actor, plays Tintin. And I think Variety or the Hollywood Reporter said he makes Tintin as unboring as possible for such a dull character. You know, Tintin is a very sort of milquetoast little fellow. And when you're saying that your lead is, you know, not that boring, that's not really exactly a strong compliment.
Well, you know, but I'm reading the comic books to my children right now. They love it. And I'm thinking to myself, why? Nothing ever happens in these stories. Ever.
Oh, they're filled with adventure.
Okay, well, I should note that I am starting out from the very first comic book. So they're trying to, I guess, establish his character.
Which one are you reading? I assume you're not gonna. I assume you'll skip the racist ones.
I think the very first one is the most racist, at least
so far. Tintin in Congo?
No, it's Tintin in the land of the Soviets.
Yeah, though that's not racist. That's just considered, you know, they stopped using it for years because it was too friendly to them, I think, in a way.
Oh, okay. Well,
no, it's Tintin in America and Tintin in Congo, I think, that are a little dicey.
Okay.
As far as racial stereotypes for the Indians and Africans.
Okay. Well, I certainly haven't gotten to that one yet.
Well, glance at those books before you plunge into them.
I probably should have glanced at all of the books before I decided to read a comic book to my children and have to explain certain things like communism, the Soviet Union, World War II, World War I. You know, yeah, it's kind of, you know, trying to explain all of that to a, you know, 4 or 5 or 6 year old, not a lot of fun.
Next time you'll just plot them in front of the TV and put in a DVD.
Yeah, pretty much. Do what every other parent does. But, you know, speaking of movies, I should say, we are going to be talking about some movies that have, you know, non-English roles, let's say. In fact, we'll be talking a little bit about the potential nominees for this year's Best Foreign Language Academy Award. That was my way of saying that. I did a very poor job of it, but there you go. We'll also explain how your DVR can be rather helpful beyond just recording your favorite television shows. In fact, it might be able to predict box office disasters and save iffy television series from being canceled. And don't worry if you don't understand that, we'll explain. We also talk about some publishing industry news during Inside Baseball. Of course, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines during Big Deal or Big Whoop and end with some correspondence from listeners. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire, and he even plays one at Comic-Con, Michael Giltz, to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
It's another week where we haven't gotten a really strong breakdown of overseas box office information. We've gotten word about what looked like the top 4 or 5 films scattered here and there as little nuggets of info inside other box office stories. So these are very tentative, but as best as we can determine right now, the number one movie around the world is Real Steel, the Hugh Jackman film, which also stayed atop the U.S. box office for the second weekend.
Hopefully, that, you know, we're still waiting to see if it stayed.
Well, there'll be Tuesday numbers. It might switch again. But for the moment, it looks like it's ahead by a hair's breadth. It's at $40 million worldwide and $108 million total so far. It looks like it's going to do a lot better overseas than it did in the U.S. The number two movie around the world is The Three Musketeers reboot, which grossed $20 million worldwide. It's about to open up in the U.S. And number three around the world is Johnny English Reborn, the James Bond spoof starring Rowan Atkinson, a.k.a. Mr. Bean. That grossed $17.3 million worldwide. It's at $85 million total, and it, too, is just about to open in the U.S. And number four is the number two movie for the North American weekend, or perhaps the number one once the final figures come out. And that movie is Footloose, the remake of the Kevin Bacon classic. Is that the word? It grossed $16.1 million in North America compared to the $16.3 estimated for Real Steel. On Friday, Footloose looked like it was going to be the number one movie for the weekend. But then Saturday morning, Real Steel really pulled in the families a huge amount. It really has a strong family appeal, apparently. Footloose, on the other hand, is doing really, really well in the South and the Heartland. This movie is a monster in Middle America.
But wait a second. So what you're saying is Footloose had Real Steel on the ropes, but Real Steel fought back to win the number one spot at the box office this week.
Yeah, well, we've gone to the judges for a final ruling because the numbers could flip again one final time, but that's how it looks.
I can't believe you were able to like pick up on that and run with it. That's very good.
At number five is The Thing remake, or as Box Office Profits called it, questionably, is it a requel or a premake? Because it's sort of a weird combination of different ideas. But The Thing grossed $8.7 million in North America. Definitely a disappointment, though it only cost about
$1.50.
I think it cost $10 million. I don't see a budget listed here, but I think it was a very inexpensive movie to make. I think the studio said something like $10 million at one point.
Well, they had to film it in Antarctica, so I don't know how it could have been cheap.
So they're expecting with DVD and all that that they won't lose their shirt. At number six is the George Clooney film The Ides of March, which held pretty well. It grossed $7.5 million. It's at $22 million total. It also is a modestly budgeted film. I think that was around $20 or $22 million. So ultimately, they think they'll be okay. At number seven is Dolphin Tale, the family film, which grossed $6.3 million. At number eight is Moneyball, which grossed another $5.5 million. It's now at $57 million total. This is all basically in North America. It's now one of the top five grossing baseball movies of all time. So when you're making a movie about baseball, you have to lower your expectations. Just like when we talk about concert films and people say, you know,
we should make a concert film for about $100 million.
Well, I'm just saying you have to put in perspective, you know, when it's one of the top grossing concert films of all time, to say it's a flop is kind of crazy. But did you spend a lot of money to make it? Not a good idea. So, you know, Moneyball is one of the top five grossing movies built around baseball in history. League of Their Own, The Rookie, Field of Dreams, The Benchwarmers, which I barely even know about, and now Moneyball. And by the time it's done, it could equal The Rookie and become the number two highest grossing film of all time in baseball.
And to do that, it would have to earn over $75 million. And to top A League of Their Own, it would have to top $107 million.
It's unlikely to do that unless somehow it gets a huge burst of attention from the Oscars and gets put back into theaters. At best, I think it might beat The Rookie. It will almost certainly equal or pass Field of Dreams, which is at $64 million. Anyway, at number nine is 50-50, the Joseph Gordon-Levitt movie about cancer. It's hilarious. It grossed $4.3 million. At number 10 is The Smurfs, which grossed another $4 million overseas. It's at $525 million worldwide and counting. At number 11 is Courageous, perhaps the most successful film in the top box office this week. It cost $2 million to make. It grossed $3.4 million this weekend alone and has $21 million total and counting. That's the recipe for Hollywood. Make a movie for pennies and you're going to make money. And at number 12, it's a tie. The Artist opened in France to $3.3 million, and it also won the Audience Award at the Hamptons International Film Festival. And it tied with The Big Year, which grossed $3.3 million. It's a movie, a comedy, starring Steve Martin, Owen Wilson, and Jack Black. It's about bird watching, and it was a remarkable flop.
Yeah, and I can't believe you could actually tell that it was about bird watching, because if you were to watch any of the commercials or even the trailer, 20th Century Fox did not know how to market this movie.
Well, they were scared. I mean, bird watching is a wildly popular pastime. I mean, tens and tens of millions of Americans go bird watching. It's unbelievable how many do. And if you watch the trailer, like you said, you had no idea what the movie was about. And if you're so afraid to discuss what your film was about, you shouldn't make it, or you should rethink your ad campaign. But a movie like this, I think, sends a chill down the spine of Hollywood people. I mean, when you spend a certain amount of money to make and market a movie and you have stars in it, people are supposed to go see it on that opening weekend. I mean, even The Thing, you know, it made $8, $9 million. No matter how bad it is, someone is supposed to show up on opening weekend. And when, like, nobody shows up and people literally just stay away in droves, it must just freak them out.
You're right. Nikki Fink is writing here on Deadline.com about how somebody told her that younger males are not showing up at the movies. That's what some studio executive told her.
Well, yeah, it's just got the guys panicking. I mean, let's remember, beginning of the year, everybody said, oh my God, it's going to be the worst year ever. Now, late summer, people said, oh my God, we're going to probably set a record and beat last year and be the second highest grossing year of all time. And now, because there's a couple down weeks with bad movies being released, they say, oh my God, everything's a disaster again. Make good movies. People will come. This year, when you look at the end, it will probably be the second highest grossing movie of all time. And to panic over one weekend or to say something stupid like, oh my God, young people aren't going to the movies anymore. It's not true.
I only said that just to kind of set you off. I knew you would say all that. But but now you talked about the summer and how the summer was quite good. And this analyst from RGC Capital Markets, David Bank, he is saying that the only write down, meaning the only film that really lost money that the studios are going to have to come out and say, okay, well, you know, here's our losses for the third quarter, is DreamWorks, Cowboys, and Aliens. All the other films did well. They didn't lose money, and they're not going to have any write-downs.
Well, what's the difference between a write-down and saying that the movie is not profitable, if anything?
Well, a write-down is it's so unprofitable that we actually are going to take the loss right now so that we can get a tax break. Because we're actually going to say, okay, we spent $100 million on this, and we earned $30, so we lost $70 million. We are putting a $70 million red mark on our books to show the loss.
So they eat the loss now, and that helps them like next quarter or next financial year when they're maybe still making a little bit of money on the DVD that can seem like profit.
Well, it's not so much about that particular film as much as the business as a whole, as to whether you're going to take a financial loss on something and whether it's beneficial tax-wise.
Mm-hmm. So it's sort of just an accounting thing, but it lets you say, okay, yeah, this one was definitely a loser.
Correct.
And you just put that aside and you're done with it, and you sort of bite the bullet early so that it doesn't haunt you for the next, you know, 6 months or year.
Yeah, and you know, that third quarter write-down announcements, you know, those are usually the ones studio executives dread the most, because the third quarter, that's when all of their summer movies came out. And if they have to start making announcements about third quarter write-downs, well, that's usually not a good sign for the studio.
Well, is there an official like announcement, or do we ever get like official info on write-downs? It'd be fun to look at every year and see, you know, like this year what all the write-downs were.
No, I don't know. I mean, yeah, they're official in terms of Wall Street official. You know, they make them official that way and in filings, but they usually don't hold press conferences to announce them.
Well, no, but we should suss that information out. That would be fun.
That would be interesting.
And of course, other information that came out this week are the list of the foreign language films that are now eligible to be nominated for the Foreign Language Film Oscar.
Apparently, if you made a film outside the United States in a foreign language, you are eligible.
You're not. You're eligible only if your country submits you. How it works is every year, every country around the world gets to submit one official film as their nominee for consideration for the Best Foreign Language Film Oscar. And so it's incredibly political, incredibly tense. Every country, you know, argues and fights over it. They set up committees. But ultimately, every country names one film, so there are like 80 or 90 movies that get nominated every year, roughly, by their country to be considered for the Best Foreign Language Oscar. Then those get broken up into like four categories. Old people who are at the Academy and have nothing else to do watch the movies, and they come down to a short list. Then we get a short list, and then everybody watches those. Then you get your five nominees. And then out of those five, people who watch all five of them get to vote on the Best Foreign Language Oscar. And that's why it's such a nutty category.
But right now, the reason I said, you know, it seems like everybody who made a foreign language film gets to be in the list of nominees, or at least the list of potential nominees, because this list goes on and on and on. There's like 70 titles on it.
Well, yeah, because there's a lot of countries. Every country wants to submit their film. You know, every country submits one film. They it's very prestigious and a big deal in their country and overseas for a movie to win the Best Foreign Language Oscar, even though it doesn't always have a big impact here at the box office in the U.S. But it's a good list. It's an interesting list. As always, you can find 5 or 10 really good movies that have been at film festivals or screened commercially, and you think, well, surely these will be the movies that you know, get on the final list, and inevitably some of them never make it, or they don't even get submitted by their country or whatever happens. But this year we've got a strong, strong list. China has The Flowers of War, which is that Christian Bale film we've been talking about for a while and directed by Zhang Yimou. Finland has Le Havre, the Aki Kaurismäki film, which just played at the New York Film Festival, as well as Cannes.
Yeah, we saw it in Canada. It is a great movie. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I did not like it as much, but a lot of other people did. In France, they submitted Declaration of War, and French films always do very well. They're always right up there. They're seen a lot by Academy voters, so they always have sort of an edge. And that movie's about parents whose child has cancer, so it's a heart tugger. Germany submitted Pina, a documentary about Pina Bausch, directed by Wim Wenders. And Pina Bausch, of course, is the great choreographer, the late great choreographer. Greece submitted Attenberg, a very strange film that I love that I saw, I think, in Toronto. It's if Dogtooth can get nominated last year or the year before, there's no reason Attenberg can't. And it's also by a female director, so that's interesting. Iran submitted A Separation, which will get an official commercial release by the end of the year. Israel submitted Footnote, the Joseph Cedar film, which I think is one of the best of the year. I hope it gets nominated.
We saw that in Cannes as well. I thought it was a very good film as well.
Yeah. Mexico had Miss Bala, which is about a beauty queen who gets caught up in the drug wars. Poland has In Darkness by Agnieszka Holland. South Africa has Beauty, a film about a closeted gay man in racist South Africa. Sweden has Beyond, a film directed by Pernilla August, which is a 70-set drama about a family riddled with abuse and alcoholism. In other words, it's your typical Swedish comedy. And Turkey had another critically acclaimed film, Once Upon a Time in Anatolia, by Nuri Bilge Ceylan, if I'm saying that name correctly.
Ceylan,
thank you. That's a huge critical favorite. And the winner is, I can tell you the winner.
Well, now, before you announce the winner, we saw Once Upon a Time in Anatolia, or slept through it, in Cannes.
Yes, we did. I found it quite compelling, actually.
I know. A lot of people kind of faulted it for being incredibly boring and incredibly slow and not really having a story. He tells some very interesting stories that take place over a long period of like 2.5 hours. and they're slow paced, and I find them magical, but a lot of people hate them.
Yeah, I didn't find this one magical, but it was interesting. I was, after you got over the whole boring hump, it did sort of have a certain interesting payoff for me. I found it interesting, but it's certainly not a crowd pleaser.
Yes, that is true.
And I can already tell you who will win the Best Foreign Language Oscar, even though they haven't even announced a shortlist, much less, you know, combed through all these movies, much less gotten down to the final five nominees. I know what's going to win.
Can you also tell me who will win the World Series, the Cardinals or the Texas Rangers?
I am rooting for the Cardinals, and therefore the Texas Rangers will win.
Ugh, can you please root for the Texas Rangers?
No, I can't.
Not when you're a Yankee fan.
That's not why, but I can't.
Okay.
So the winner for the Best Foreign Language Film is the Polish film In Darkness, directed by Agnieszka Holland.
Agnieszka Holland, yes.
Yes, who's a terrific filmmaker, hasn't made a great film in a while, but she's made some wonderful films. However, I know this is going to win because I read the plot summary, and it is a dramatization of one man's rescue of Jewish refugees in the Nazi-occupied Polish city of Lvov.
I don't think we've seen this movie before.
If you know anything about the Oscars, you know that in the short films and the foreign language films, when you're dealing with the Holocaust, by God, you've got an edge over all the competition.
That's true. Yeah, at least it seems that way.
It certainly does.
Well, now you're trying to predict the winner of the Best Foreign Language Feature Film for the Academy Awards. Studios are trying to predict whether their films are going to flop or not. And TiVo is saying, hey, we can help you, movie studios. We know whether your film is going to tank or not simply by looking at the people who fast forward through commercials. Because those who speed past certain ads, more than 40% of all households with the DVRs, viewers tend to zap ads for films they don't plan to go to see. So if your ad is skipped.
I don't like their numbers here. They're very confusing. But in general terms, obviously, a lot of people use DVRs to skip over commercials. What happens, at least for me, is occasionally I will stop and watch a commercial. And I often do that with a film trailer if I want to see the trailer. So what they're looking at is how many people skip over, if they skip over ads, do they skip over this trailer or do they watch it? And that's kind of fascinating that they see trailers for like Footloose and Puss in Boots are very popular and people tend not to skip over them. Whereas the trailer for
The
Three Musketeers is being skipped a lot, right?
Yes.
Yeah, a lot of people are skipping over the Three Musketeers ad. It does look terrible. So that's a bad sign. And they're being able to use that to predict box office potential. And they're saying, oh, it looks like, you know, this little film, Courageous, which did not have a big opening, that was extremely well watched. People stopped and watched that trailer for that film, that faith-based film about, I think it's cops, right? Yes, cop. Fireproof was the fireman. This is the cops who have a crisis of faith after a shooting. But you know, almost everybody watched that trailer who watches their commercials. So they just say, hey, look, they compile the data, say, if you get people to stop and look at your movie trailer, that's a pretty good sign that people are interested in it. Makes sense.
Yeah, but what I find interesting is that, you know, television networks and cable networks have said, oh my goodness, the DVR is ruining our ad business. And here's the figure that TiVo came up with for The Three Musketeers. About 20% of DVR users sped through ads for the Musketeers during the week that ended September 25th. You know what that means? 80% of the people didn't speed through it at all, which means 80% of the people with a DVR didn't fast forward past the commercials.
Well, they're talking about TiVo users only.
TiVo users only. And
I don't understand any of these figures. I don't know anyone with a DVR who tapes a show and then watches the ads.
Oh, you'd
be
surprised.
Maybe you're in the other room in the bathroom. Maybe you don't notice it. But even I don't even want the sound. Even if I'm going to leave the room, I pause it. I don't want to hear the commercials. I never watch a single – I rarely watch commercials. It's very unusual that I will stop and watch. I watched an ad for The Walking Dead during an episode of Breaking Bad, which is a terrific show. I've got two episodes left in the season. I watch sometimes a movie trailer, and that's about it. I do not watch any ads. Everybody I know fast forwards to their ads. Who is using their DVR and watching ads? What kind of a lunatic are you? 80% of the people? That seems insane.
Well, sometimes I'll be checking email or doing something on the computer when the ad shows up. It like gives me a moment to do something. I've tuned out the commercial. But here's the thing. When I'm fast forwarding through an ad, I actually have to pay attention. Because I've got to look at the screen, I've got to see what is on the screen, and I can usually identify the ad. Oh, that's the Toyota ad, that's the commercial for Dial soap, and that's the commercial for the Three Musketeers.
Well, they now create ads specifically so that they will make an impression and be visible and get the idea across of what the product is for people who are watching it in fast forward motion.
Yeah, so they are making their impact. They have reached me in some way, shape, or form.
Right. What I find interesting is people are not only zapping ads, sometimes they're zapping entire shows.
That's right. Well, maybe or maybe not. I mean, they're not trying to zap the television show. What they're doing is they are actually increasing the number of people who watched a show.
Well, but you know what happens sometimes is I tape new shows to sample them, like the Tim Allen show, Last Man Standing, which I actually thought was fine. I mean, I'm not going to watch it regularly, but I thought it was a perfectly good sitcom, you know, for people who want mainstream, broad, dull family sitcom. It's a perfectly watchable show. I would think that'd be a hit. Other shows I watch a few minutes of and I zap through and I don't watch them anymore. You know, I zap, I've sampled this. I don't need to watch this whole episode. I never got through an entire episode of Charlie's Angels. Let's put it that way. And just as it looked like Charlie's Angels was stabilizing in the ratings, and I told a friend, nah, it looks like it might be around for a while, they've canceled the show. And one reason is because not a lot of people were taping that show and watching it. So there was no good news, really, for Charlie's Angels. Pan Am, on the other hand, has some good news. A lot of people are, a couple million people are taping Pan Am, which is on ABC, and watching the show. The problem is, however, there aren't enough of them. And if the show's ratings have dropped from 3 weeks in a row after its debut, it started up here, and then it dropped second week, third week, and that's really when you're supposed to stabilize. And now it's fourth week overnight numbers. It's dropped again steadily. So that's very bad news for Pan Am.
Yeah, you know, actually, it's funny because 2 weeks ago, we were talking about how NBC wasn't going to cancel the Playboy Club and Free Agents. At least that's what Deadline was saying. And they were going to try and give those shows some room to breathe and prove to the creative community that, you know, here we're really standing up for you. But then apparently the first ratings that included time delayed viewing, so the live plus three or live plus seven, as they're referred to, they came out last Monday. And that's when you saw all of these shows start to get canceled. So you mentioned Charlie's Angels, of course, the Playboy Club and Free Agents we mentioned last week, How to Be a Gentleman we mentioned last week, and Hater as well, all got canceled.
Right. And I think we showed a little cynicism about NBC's comments because, you know, they just had so many holes to fill that they weren't any huge rush to cancel shows because they had no good news. But even they were forced to admit some of these shows aren't working. They're going to, you know, expand Dateline an hour. Brian Williams has a new show. I mean, they're just in terrible straits. But it's true. If people tape shows and watch them, that can keep a show alive.
Well, some of these shows, like Up All Night, had a 46% increase from a 2.4 rating, which is considered actually pretty good to begin with, and it jumped up to 3.5. Fringe, which is, you know, really, it's on Friday, it's barely watched by anyone, went from 1.5 for its, you know, premiere, a 1.5 rating for its premiere, and it jumped up to a 2.3. So a lot of these shows are
That's nothing, you know. Fringe.
On a Friday?
Yeah, I mean, Fringe. That's not a high rating at any time of the year. I mean, Fringe will presumably, this is its last season. But I mean, we thought that about Chuck, which should have been canceled about 2 or 3 years ago, and that's still around. But I don't think Fringe will last again. It's really not doing well on Friday nights, even when you count in the people watching it on DVR.
Well, yeah, but a lot of these shows, I guess what they're saying is they're really being saved in some instances by...
But again, no, I say no. They're not being saved. Up All Night is not canceled because NBC has holes on every night of its schedule. It is not a success story. Whitney is not a success story. They're simply desperate. They can't cancel everything that's not working because they'd have no television shows on the air. They have football in the top 30 and that's it. NBC is in free fall. They cannot cancel these shows. If they had any sort of a decent schedule, Up All Night would be canceled. Whitney would probably be canceled. You know, the Playboy Club was such a disaster, they had to cancel it, you know.
But now, wait a second here. I guess, you know, the New York Times is saying that
they're wrong.
The Up All Night at 3.5 rating on a difficult night is inching close to hit territory.
That's ridiculous.
Bill Carter of the New York Times saying that.
On Thursday nights, which is what we're talking about, CBS is the number one show. Fox is probably number one or certainly number two with the young demographics because it is the X factor. Even Charlie's Angels was ranking ahead of the NBC shows at 8 o'clock. Grey's Anatomy is ahead of the NBC shows at 9 o'clock and CBS as well.
Well, wait a second. Let's just – what?
NBC has four sitcoms and Prime Suspect. Community a week and a half ago was ranked number 86. Parks and Recreation was ranked number 70. Their lone hit, and I put that in quotes on Thursday, is The Office, which is ranked at 54 and has trended down after years of building an audience very, very modestly, mind you. But now that Steve Carell's gone, it has dropped down. So it's down on the downward slope. That's
well,
at number 54.
Let me ask you this. X Factor?
Whitney at number 9 at 9:30 drops to number 64, and Prime Suspect is ranked number 62. So their highest ranked show on Thursday night is 54, The Office, which is not doing well. Everything else is moribund, to say the least. They're beating the CW, but that's about it.
Okay, but now the X Factor, I mean, it's considered a hit, right? I mean, we're going to call this a hit show,
yes,
even though it didn't
yes.
get the 20 million people that Simon Cowell predicted it would, and that was just
and I thought it would do better as well, but there have been so many, you know, talent shows that it's been overwhelmed. But yes, it's a hit. It's ranked, it's in the top 20. It's ranked number 16.
Okay, what is its rating? Like the when they say it's got a blank point blank rating, what is its rating?
Its rating is, well, I'm looking at a thing that includes the number of viewers, which is 11.7 million viewers. It's ranked number 16. Whitney is ranked number 64.
And how many millions of viewers does it have?
4.9 million viewers.
Okay, because I guess that's what I'm trying to find out, is when they say, oh, it's a 4.8 rating.
No, the rating is slightly, that's a household rating. Here it is. I save USA Today every week, and they translate it into millions of viewers.
Okay.
The rating is like a household thing. So you have more viewers than you have in the ratings. Like a 2.3 rating might equal a slightly higher actual number of people watching the show. So, but look, it's 4.9 million viewers. It's ranked 64th. Of all shows in that week.
And I guess what you're saying is, look, you're bringing me 5 million viewers every week. Thank you very much. Yeah, not enough.
Well, I mean, but for NBC, it is. I mean, it's not a hit. It's not doing well. It's ranked third at 9 o'clock, and it's probably third or fourth in demographics. And it's just not doing well. But NBC has so many problems, they'll stick with it.
Yeah, well, and I wonder if like a year or two from now, whether you know, these shows find a bigger audience, and whether they found that audience because they were given enough time and enough of an audience found them, or just because, heck, it's the only thing on and, it, you know, people just got used to it.
Well, it's always good when a network shows patience for a show that works creatively and they feel like it's they can spot some glimmer of hope in the ratings and think it might build into a hit. The Office has never been a big hit, but they've been patient with that, and that's certainly an acclaimed show. Some shows break out of the box right away, like Grey's Anatomy. Other shows take time to build an audience. You know, that happens all the time, and that's great. Whitney is not a well-reviewed show, and it's not doing well in the ratings, but NBC is desperate, so they're keeping it on the air.
And I guess the same would be said. I mean, Up All Night, everybody I know who's seen that show loves it, and I've watched it, and it's funny.
I haven't watched it yet. That's on Wednesdays at 8 o'clock. It's opposite The X Factor, which is ranked number 14, Survivor, which is still in the top 25. And ABC has a pretty good comedy block on Wednesdays. It has The Middle, which I have a certain fondness for, and Suburgatory, which has done pretty well. And then their big hit, which is Modern Family, which leaps into the top 10. And then Happy Endings, which has not done well at all. Though a lot of critics thought Happy Endings was the most improved sitcom last year. You know, it started off weak and got stronger and got a more distinctive comedy voice. It's sort of a new Friends type show. Critics like it, but it's not doing well at all. It probably isn't for long days because everything else on Wednesday is doing pretty good for ABC.
Well, and I guess to kind of underscore it, I highlighted a story here that initially kind of caught my eye because I thought, wow, you know, The Big Bang Theory, a new episode on Thursday garnered 13.3 million viewers. That's a lot. That's more than The X Factor. And then a repeat got 12 million. A repeat of the show got 12 million. But then I realized, well, wait a second. The repeat was right after the original episode. So, you know, it was just kind of follow through viewers that.
Well, yes, but I mean, the point is that the week before that, it was The Big Bang Theory had 13.9 million viewers. And that was followed by How to Be a Gentleman, a new original episode of a new original sitcom. And that dropped by almost 50%. It had only 7.6 million viewers. So
you can see why they canceled that show.
Right. That's why they canceled it. And they're bringing back in, I think, Rules of Engagement to run at 8:30. Is that what they're
putting
on
Thursday? Something like that. Yeah.
Yeah, so the news there was that How to Be a Gentleman was doing terrible. Sitcoms tend to repeat better than dramas. You can't even repeat a drama anymore. They do so poorly. You just can't show reruns of dramas. But again, CBS has been number one on Thursday for a number of years now. That's The Big Bang Theory and then Person of Interest, which is doing pretty good, ranked 17th. And then at 10 o'clock is The Mentalist, which is the top 10 show. So they have the number 7 show of the week, and the number 10 show of the week, and the number 17 show of the week. So that's three top 20 shows. They're doing great.
The official Twitter account for The Mentalist television show started following me on Twitter. And I just thought, I'm sorry, I'm a fan of Psych. And they don't like The Mentalist because they think you copied them.
I think the tone is a little different, though. I think it's definitely a similar idea, but Psych has had a great run, and The Mentalist is – I like Simon Baker, so I'm happy to see him in a hit.
Well, I know we're talking numbers here and how TiVo has or has not affected the ratings and whether it matters or not, and a lot of people wondered whether – Facebook getting into music would matter for bands and for musicians and for artists. And actually what an initial report is finding is no, not really. It doesn't help at all. You don't get any more fans through all this social listening than you would if you just kind of existed on Facebook naturally.
Well, what the heck? I mean, didn't this happen like a week ago?
Well, no, they're just now kind of analyzing the numbers now.
But I mean, but didn't Facebook Music launch like a week ago?
Yes, it launched about two, three weeks ago.
So they're not only telling us it didn't work.
Well, I guess what they were hoping, you know, that what they were really trying to see is in that week, that launch, they expected to see these big spikes in the quote-unquote likes of certain artists. And they looked at the most popular artists on Facebook and the growth of their web pages or their Facebook pages. And they saw that the number of likes or fans did not sharply increase as they had thought it would. It kind
They're measuring how many fans listen to music and then actively like a page of the artist that they're listening to.
Or get their friends to like it. So, for instance, if I was listening to, I'll just pick Justin Bieber out of a hat here. Justin Bieber.
Baby.
Right? And I'm rocking out to it. You log on to Facebook, Michael. You see that I'm listening to Justin Bieber. Click on the little, you know, ticker and then like him as well. So now my listening to Justin Bieber has gotten you to like his page. They thought that that would really increase the number of likes or fans for certain artists, and it just hasn't.
Well, we can both look forward to Justin Bieber performing on Dick Clark's Rockin' New Year's Eve, hosted by Ryan Seacrest. That's happening at the end of the year. So that's something for us to like and look forward to. But the original article that this article linked to is sort of an inside Facebook website. It's sort of like, you know, those people who just obsess over Apple or Facebook or whatever the thing may be. This is a website devoted to all things Facebook. And what they were complaining about was saying, look, Facebook has yet to make it easy for people to like the artist pages of music that they're listening to or to share that with their friends and get them to like it. So what they were saying is, look, you're not making it easy for people to do this. The numbers aren't rising because it's not a simple one-click thing to do. And they're saying that artists in the record industry should encourage Facebook to make another tweak and make it easier for people who are listening to, you know, Spotify or radio or whatever on their Facebook page to be able to easily go, oh, wait, I like this. Let me like their page. So they were complaining it's not a simple thing to do.
Yeah, it's a two-click thing instead of a one-click thing, and the like button is smaller. And yeah,
right. So it's been out for like a week or two. So to determine, oh, it's not working is ridiculous. And in fact, these people were pointing to a flaw, you know, pointing to one particular thing, the liking of an artist page, which isn't that easy to do or could be done more easily. So, you know, give it a couple months.
All right. Well, I guess they were looking at that first initial bump is what they were hoping to see, and they didn't see it. But now, you haven't listened to Spotify yet, have you?
Do you have to pay for it?
No, it's free now.
Oh, yeah. No, I have too much music. I don't need to do those
things. Right. I keep forgetting. But, you know, I haven't really been listening to Pandora as much as I probably should be. I was a very early user of Pandora way back in 2006. And, of course, this is the... I mean, how would you describe it? It's not only social radio, but it kind of creates the radio for you based on algorithms. So you say, oh, I like Miles Davis, and it'll put a whole radio station together for you of music that's similar to Miles Davis as well as Miles Davis's music. It went public earlier this year, and now they're saying that it has more listeners than actual radio, but that the ad dollars aren't showing up and more people use it on mobile than actually listen to it at home. So 70% of the service's usage happens on smartphones and tablets.
Right. If you listen to Pandora, you're probably not sitting at your computer. You're listening to it on your phone or your tablet while you're traveling around.
Correct. Yeah. And, you know, look, I go get a haircut. The radio is on. It's not the radio. It's Pandora.
And yet advertisers are not putting their money into mobile.
That's right. Yeah. That's the big problem here is that they haven't figured it out yet.
What surprised me was their claim. This is a Bloomberg News article, which states it as simply a fact. I don't know what their basis for it is, but they claim that Pandora has bigger audiences in New York and LA than those cities' biggest radio stations. So if they were a radio station, Pandora would be ranked number one in New York and number one in LA I find that stunning. I'd love to know what the figures are and where they got them and how they came up with this, but they state it as if it's just a known fact.
Well, because they can actually track, you know, the incoming requests to a specific IP address, and they know where those requests are coming from based on the IP addresses they come from. So actually, you can probably track that more accurately than you could radio listenership.
Request one song once that I'm a listener for that day? Or how do they translate my request to hear one song on Pandora into radio listenership viewers? You know, Pandora claims this? Okay, fine. But how do they claim this? What's their basis? How do they break down their numbers? You know, Bloomberg just repeats it as gospel. You think a business thing would do better than that, but they don't.
They don't. And now, speaking of business, we should probably take care of some business before we move on. This is kind of an in-house ad. I just wanted to kind of take a moment to say, hey, you know, you can write to us by email. dirt@showbizsandbox.com is the email address, dirt@showbizsandbox.com, or you can call us and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Not everybody makes it to the end of the show where we say those the email address and the phone number, so I just thought I'd take a moment to say them here before we move on to theater news. Now, Michael, you already talked about some of the musical theater festival that's taking place. And now there's a bunch of theater news that's happening with existing musicals and plays.
That's right. Billy Elliot posted a closing notice. So the long-running smash Billy Elliot closes on Broadway January 8th. If you haven't seen it, come to Broadway and see a show and do it fast. It's still playing in London, but it's a very, very good show. It will have run for 1,344 performances. That makes it number 64 on the all-time list of Broadway hits. That includes both plays and musicals. So of every show that's ever played on Broadway, it's the 64th longest-running show.
Well, this is the Elton John, you know, crafted musical, right?
That's right.
Is based on the movie, the hit movie.
Yes. It's the musical based on the hit film. Billy Elliot began previews in October of 2008. So you're looking at slightly over
3 years.
Yeah, just over 3 years. And that makes it the 64th longest running show in Broadway history, plays or musicals. So keep that in mind of what a big smash hit that is for running 3 years. When we say something like Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark just has to run for 3 or 4 years to break even.
Yeah,
so
well,
keep that in mind. The funny thing is that Billy Elliot is on the list just behind Funny Girl, and the show that's going to replace it in the theater that it's been sitting in on Broadway for 3 years is in fact a revival of Funny Girl, starring Lauren Ambrose and Bobby Cannavale. So that's kind of a nice bit of synchronicity.
Well, that actually sounds like a great cast. I know you love Bobby Cannavale, and I'm I'd like to see Lauren Ambrose in something.
Well, I don't know how they can both sing. So we know she can sing, but you know, those are big shoes to fill. It'll be definitely interesting. You know, I'm rooting for them. They're going to be in LA for 5 weeks, so you have a chance to see them.
Oh, really?
They come to Broadway in April. So get your tickets now. It'll be a hot ticket.
Yeah, I will definitely see them in LA. Thank you for letting me know that. Now,
one show that won't be coming to Broadway right away is The King's Speech.
Right. No, and I hate to tell you this, Michael. That is a movie, not a Broadway musical or a Broadway play.
Well, it was almost essentially written as a play and then turned into a film script and then became a film. And everybody immediately said, wow, this would make a great play. And plans were bubbling. But now it looks like the show will tour the UK before hitting the West End and then maybe come to Broadway down the road after that if all goes well. At first, it looked like it might go straight to Broadway, but it's not happening yet.
Let me get this straight. They're going to turn a movie, a feature film, into a Broadway show, like
into a play.
So yeah. Kind of like, well, I guess I was going to say Hairspray, but that's a musical. But I don't know. I was trying to be ironic and humorous here, saying once again we have a film being turned into a musical now, or a play on Broadway.
Yeah, a Broadway show, a theatrical show.
Right.
It happens all the time. But they're going to tour the hinterlands of the UK before coming to the West End. And Charles Edwards will play King George VI. He was in The 39 Steps, which was a stage adaptation of the Hitchcock film that was very funny. And he played it in both London and Broadway, where it ran for quite a long time. Jonathan Hyde is an Australian actor, and he will play the Lionel Logue character. That's the speech therapist. Neither one is a huge draw or big name. I thought a show like this could easily draw a really big stage actor because they're such fun, meaty roles. I thought you would have two big names. So it's interesting that they went for people who are not particularly well known. there you go. I imagine that might change if it comes to Broadway, unless these two guys, you know, get so acclaimed in the roles that they, you know, make them their own.
Speaking of not particularly well known, do you think anybody will go see this musical about Susan Boyle, who is the singing YouTube sensation, you know, 300 million views on YouTube, that, you know, her appearance on Britain's Got Talent. She's the kind of frumpy woman who came out and sang beautifully, and now she's a, you know, multi-platinum recording artist, and her first album sold 10 million copies, her second album sold 4 million copies. And do you think that they're going to turn this story into a musical called I Dreamed a Dream, which was the name of the song she sang? Do you think anybody's going to go see that?
Well, I'd never rule Susan Boyle out. I think something like this is perhaps more appealing to people than to actually listen to her third or fourth album. You know, like the story of her is probably as appealing as listening to the music. So, I mean, her debut album is the best-selling UK debut of all time in that country. So, you know, she's had massive success as a recording artist. Maybe she's not done. I don't know. What I found interesting is that she's actually going to tour with it, I guess, and come out at the end of the show and sing her big song.
You know, I couldn't figure that out, whether it was her or her character that comes out at the end and sings the song, meaning that.
You wrote that. I thought you were saying that in the show notes. I thought you were saying that she'll actually tour with it and, you know, pop out as herself at the end of it.
I couldn't figure out. I copied and pasted it from this story on Deadline.com.
That's what they're repeating. You know, it's a press conference by Michael Harrison, who's the producer of the show, which is called I Dreamed a Dream, the musical biography of Susan Boyle. It starts in March of 2012. And, you know, they interviewed him and spoke to him. So presumably when they say that she comes out at the end to sing the song, that's what's going to happen. But that seems awfully expensive to have her sitting around the whole night just waiting to come out at the finale.
Yeah, I don't think it's probably just her character.
Well, no, they say it's her. They say, I mean, obviously everybody knows the show will climax with that, but they're saying, well, maybe not. I guess the actress would sing it in the middle because she's got all her, maybe, I don't know how the show's structured. Who cares?
Well, something that you did care about and you did go see was The Mountaintop, which stars Samuel L. Jackson as Martin Luther King and Angela Bassett, I guess, as
a hotel maid,
yes. So what did you think?
Well, I'll go see anything on Broadway. I mean, if I Dreamed a Dream starring Susan Boyle comes to Broadway, by God, I'll go review it. I'll happily, you know, see anything. But The Mountaintop, I have to say, was a little disappointing. It came from London, where it won the Olivier for Best Play last year, I believe. People were excited about it. It's a young female African-American playwright. And two young female African-American playwrights have shows on Broadway this fall. It's rare for two women to have a show on in any season, much less two African-American women. So that was great to see. It just didn't quite live up to the hype. It was okay. I mean, if you get over your expectation that you're going to see a great show, it's entertaining, it's fun. Both actors are strong in their roles. I didn't like the way it was produced. I didn't like the production design, how they did the finale. I felt that detracted from it. We get sort of a monologue at the end where you chart through the 50 years of history since Dr. King was assassinated. That's not revealing anything. But it's done in like a multimedia way where you've got video and photographs and stuff flashing across the stage. And it's like, you know what? It's theater. Like, do what theater does well. Just let the performer deliver a monologue and, you know, draw us in with our imagination. Don't give us, you know, an IMAX viewing. But I thought both actors were good. Samuel L. Jackson was solid. And Angela Bassett had a lot of fun. She probably had the night's highlight when she does an earlier monologue where she tells Dr. King what she would tell the striking workers to do. And it's very blue, very funny, very angry. But, you know, a really well done monologue. She really, you know, did a great job with that. They're both good. It's a fun, entertaining show. I think crowds will like it. Critics were quite mixed on it, as they should be. But I think it's, you know, inexpensive to do. It's two actors, one set. You know, I think it'll be fine.
Now, did you see Lawrence Fishburne in Thurgood, which was kind of the story of Thurgood Marshall? Because in that show, there was no video. It was just Lawrence Fishburne as Thurgood Marshall, one man, and it was a one-man show, and it was all monologue. It was very good.
No, I missed it. Oh, I'm sorry that happened. I believe I was living out of the city at that time.
Well, I thought that HBO turned Thurgood into a movie, at least for their television.
They did.
Okay. Well, then maybe you can buy it on iTunes. And shortly, when you purchase it on iTunes, according to the Wall Street Journal and several other sources, you won't have to download Thurgood or any other movie from a Hollywood studio or television network onto your hard drive. You'll be able to stream it directly from iTunes. I mean, it's not really a competitor to Netflix then, because you'll still have to buy it.
Right, you buy it, but you don't get a copy of it. This is interesting. Warner Brothers has been doing this for a few months now. It's called their version of it is called Ultraviolet. It used to be that when you, well, used to be in the last year or so, sometimes when you buy a DVD, you also get the right to a digital download. And I kind of like it. You get a combo pack a lot of times. You get a Blu-ray, you get a regular DVD, and you get a digital copy, which you download. And so you can watch the movie on your Blu-ray player, on your PlayStation 3. You can take the DVD and watch it in the car, on your laptop, or on your boat, or your second home.
Do you get the boat, the second house, or the DVD in the car?
That's extra. Okay. You got to pay separately for that.
Okay.
So I really like that. And people like getting that digital download flexibility where they don't have to decide what way they want to watch the movie in advance. Just let them watch it any way they want. You know, let them decide. Give them every option. Say if they want the movie, let them watch it any way they want. And that's great. But now what Warner Brothers is doing with Ultraviolet is they say, oh, you're not going to download that movie anymore. That's such a pain. You're just going to stream it.
That's right.
And if you go online to Amazon, people are furious about this because they buy these combo packs and they think they're buying a digital copy. In fact, it says a digital copy, but then in small letters, you know, streaming. They found out, no, you don't get to download a copy and physically own it. What you get is the right to stream it. So that raises all sorts of issues, like how long will you have the right to stream it? What happens if, you know, the company goes out of business or a new company goes over or it's a new format? You know, now you're not buying a movie. You're just getting the access to stream it occasionally. So you have to have a connection. You have to be streaming it. You have to have that content go over the wire. So that builds up your Wi-Fi cost, you know, of your, especially if you don't have unlimited
data,
you know,
plan.
Right. Exactly. So this raises tons of issues.
Yeah. And there's something they've been talking about for a while, and Warner Brothers finally announced last week. And there's a couple studios that are a part of Ultraviolet. Remarkably, Disney is not a part of it. They have their own little, technology that they're trying to push on people. But I find it interesting that, you know, you buy a CD, a music album, and you can stick it on your computer, rip it, and you can then, you know, have it on your iPod or your iPhone, right?
Right.
With a movie.
Or your laptop.
Or your laptop, yeah. A movie, what they're saying is buy the DVD/Blu-ray. So that's already a combo pack. We're giving you two for the price of not one because they're charging you extra. And we'll even charge you extra for the very same file, the digital download, that you could do yourself if we allowed you to rip the DVD.
Well, people can rip DVDs,
they
right?
can, yes. Techies can, but, you know, for
not me.
The average person, it's not difficult, but you have to explain how to do it. Now, maybe if there was software like iTunes that allowed you to rip it, it would be easier. In the case of Ultraviolet, what they're saying is not only don't you have to rip it, but you don't have to download a file either. You can just stream it.
Right, but again, that raises all sorts of issues. All right, so now you don't own it. You just have, just like your ebooks, you don't own it. You just have the right to look at it for a while until they ever want to take it back. Or maybe they want to re-edit it or change it or put, you know, or the company goes out of business or, you know, whatever. The consortium breaks up that's behind it. It just, it's very upsetting to me. What do you do on planes or trains or things where you don't have that, you know, internet connection? Plus, it does massively increase your usage of the bandwidth, which every internet company in the world is trying to say, hey, we're going to put a cap on that and start charging you extra. They're crazy to do that. That's their foaming at the mouth to do that. So just when they're going to start charging us for our bandwidth usage, because most people right now have unlimited bandwidth, the studios are going to come in and say, guess what? Your bandwidth is going to dramatically increase because you're going to have to stream all these movies whenever you want to watch them digitally.
These bandwidth caps that you referred to?
Uh-huh.
Well, who owns Universal again? Who is it that owns, you know?
Oh, Comcast.
Comcast. And what do they also own?
Cable and internet.
Right. So basically they're creating a system that will force you to have to use high-speed internet, which, by the way, they also happen to provide.
Really? You think the reason they're doing this is to force you to upgrade your cable bill, your cables and Wi-Fi system?
No, not at all. I think the reason they're doing this is multi-fold, and just some of the reasons are it prevents piracy. So that's number one. And it's,
why does it prevent piracy? They put out the DVDs. Anybody who's a pirate can rip it and give it to anyone in the world. There's a master copy, pristine, available to any pirate in the world. This does not eliminate piracy. It doesn't do a thing about piracy. It just makes it more difficult for regular fans who want to watch a movie easily and simply.
So wait.
It has nothing to do with piracy because any pirate can get a DVD copy that's pristine. So it does nothing to prevent piracy. Nothing.
I'm confused. You're saying that DRM actually prevents honest people who have paid for the content from watching,
yes,
and or listening to the content itself?
In legal ways that they should be allowed to do. Absolutely.
This is a whole new concept that DRM could possibly be.
But it's not about piracy because it doesn't do a thing about piracy unless they were getting rid of all, you know, DVDs as well.
Well, yes. And if you could, actually, let me give you a few phone numbers to some studios, because apparently the technology people in the industry have not been able to convince them of this.
But I mean, you're joking, right? They know it. They know it's a joke to pretend that it's about piracy. Not when they're putting out Blu-rays and DVDs of a movie. Can they claim that we can't offer digital download because of piracy?
Well, they're also trying to get into, you know, they realize that their distribution channels are going to be more difficult as time moves on. You don't need a middleman. And so what they're trying to do is lock you in to their systems so that they can continue to sell you content.
Huh?
And that's why they bought Flixster. That's why Warner Brothers, which is behind Ultraviolet, bought Flixster.
I'm confused.
Well, Flixster is...
You mean because the stores are closing? Or, you know, there are fewer...
Yeah, so that way they can say, hey, you know what? Don't go to iTunes. Don't go to Best Buy. Just come to us. We've got all these movies. So you buy them from us and, you know, we'll keep them for you.
But Ultraviolet isn't about them selling it directly to you. They're doing it through the DVDs that you buy in the stores. When you buy a DVD, you get the Ultraviolet option as well.
For now, it is.
Right. So you're saying if they can stream it, then they don't need a middleman now. They can sell you DVDs direct. They can sell you digital downloads direct.
That
doesn't make it easier for them to sell you DVDs or digital downloads or streaming directly. They've always had the ability to do that. So this doesn't change that either.
No, but you know what really needs to change is consumer behavior. And consumer behavior does not change overnight. So it's a lot easier to put, you know, one little stepping stone in place first and get people to understand that you can come to Flixster and watch your movies. And what, you know what? Next month, next year, you can not only come to Flixster and watch your movies, but you can also buy them here as well. Why go to Amazon? You can just come straight here where you watch all of your movies.
Fair enough.
So it's kind of a, you know, if they were to say, oh, we're not selling through Amazon anymore and you can only come to Flixster and buy your Warner Brothers movies here, that would never work. And so they're just, it's an experiment and we'll see if it sticks around. Who knows? But, you know, certainly.
Fans hate it.
Fans hate it, and as you mentioned, you know, it can be quite difficult to rip a DVD, and, you know, a group
It's going to increase your Wi-Fi bill. Thanks, Hollywood.
And Apple has always tried to make things easier. In fact, there was a story on The Wrap that said, and this is a rumor that's been going on forever, it seems like at least a couple of years, that Steve Jobs' last big project at Apple before he passed away was the final screen, that he had conquered the PC, so that was the first screen, he had conquered the phone, and so that's, you know, the second screen. And he had conquered mobile devices with the iPad. And that the final screen was going to be in the living room with a television. He was going to make a television that was, you know, better than anything else, that had all of this, you know, no set-top boxes. Everything was in the TV.
Well, there's no question that, you know, TVs are a pain in the neck. If you've ever tried to go into someone else's home and turn the TV on and watch cable and or DVD or whatever, it's a nightmare because every system seems to be incompatible with everybody else. Everybody's got three or four remotes by their TV. I mean, it's a big pain in the neck. So that's why people have always dreamt of Apple coming in and doing it right for so many years.
Right. You know, they have Apple TV and that will, you know, is an extra box and that will.
Well, that's a streaming thing to get content from your laptop to your television, right?
Partially. And the other part is you can, you know, rent movies from iTunes and buy movies from iTunes. So,
right.
You know, I don't know. It'll be very interesting to see what happens here, whether they actually go into that kind of home electronics. But, you know, the gentleman from The Wrap, Michael Stroud, suggested that imagine just turning on a TV that looked like a giant iPad and allowed you to easily browse the internet, play all your songs, get any TV or movie content you wanted, and so on. Would you buy a new TV? Would you switch to a cable company that offered a 60-inch screen for $199 as part of a 2-year commitment? Suppose the price of getting a TV screen was making a lot more network content available a la carte. So it is, when you think about it, as far as groundbreaking, industry-changing moves, he's right.
Well, the only reason it's being talked about is because their newest operating system for the iPhone includes support for a next-generation Apple TV-type device. So they said, oh, look at this. Maybe this is finally the TV we've been waiting for. But there's really no new news here.
Yeah. And by the way, can I thank Apple for its iOS 5 update, which completely screwed up my iPad and several iPhones that I updated? I'd like to thank them.
I actually just saw the agony and ecstasy of Steve Jobs. It's a one-man show at the Public starring Mike Daisy. Mike Daisy, is that his name?
Yes, I think so. And he's kind of a well-known monologuist.
Yes, a la Spalding Gray. And his new show is all about his love affair with technology and Apple in particular and Steve Jobs. And he actually travels to China to the factory where half of the stuff you own is made. Literally half of everything.
Yeah, Foxconn.
All electronics, Foxconn. And it was a good show, but he has a lot of back and forth with Steve Jobs, and he curses them for their forced upgrades at one point in the show. So I'm sure you could identify.
Oh, yes. It's kind of, you know, I guess iOS 5 is being seen as a big deal by some people. Yes, that was my lame way of transferring us into Big Deal or Big Whoop, our segment where we discuss the top entertainment news stories of the week and decide whether they are a big deal or if anyone should care about them. Now, speaking of, I guess, digital distribution and digital services, since Netflix is hitting the wall as far as U.S. shows it can snap up, the company is headed overseas. More and more, Netflix is buying the rights to international shows like Lilyhammer, a Swedish drama. I thought it was a Norwegian drama.
Oh, I beg your pardon.
That Steve Van Zandt plays a gangster in the witness protection program. The Italian Borgia spin on Tom Fontana's Borgia U.S. miniseries. An Australian show about tween mermaids. Ooh, I've always wanted to see that kind of show. Which has proven a success for them. And so on. Is this a push into foreign titles? A big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big whoop. It's been happening for a little while. It's perfectly natural. There's great content all over the world, and there's no reason not to make it available to people in the U.S. And presumably, you won't have to pay through the nose for the content. Plus, I know a lot of people in the U.S., like I have a Senegalese friend who pays a lot of money for monthly access to African shows from his home country. You know, the more all that material can be available to people all over the world, the better. I mean, why not?
Yeah, I think those kinds of territorial barriers for content are being broken down.
Yeah, just like books need to be sold by language rather than by territory, I think TV shows and films and all that increasingly will be sold by language as well. It just makes sense.
Now Hollywood screenwriters can watch their most cherished scripts not be turned into a movie online. Yes, The Blacklist, the annual survey that determines the hottest unproduced screenplays in Hollywood every year, has launched a website. They've always had a website, but I guess they've rejiggered the website. It's open only to industry professionals, and steps are taken to avoid people pumping up their own scripts and trashing the competition. The scripts tend to be challenging and bold affairs that studios love but never actually make. In beta testing, the most popular script overall for the past few months was the Imitation Game. I almost said The Imagination Game. The story is about a gay math whiz, World War II hero, and a father of the computer who was hounded for being gay in the 1952,
Alan Turing.
Yes, and the Turing test, and he committed suicide ultimately.
Well, he was driven to it, frankly.
Yes, and he's kind of an unsung hero of technology. It's just been optioned by Warner Brothers. Zac Efron may be in the lead. Actually, that's not true. Leonardo DiCaprio was the group that optioned it. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
You know, it's a big whoop overall. Great for the creator behind it. It's a new step. I think they charge like $20 a month for access to it. So you're sort of self-selecting the people who are going to be on the website, but it's not open to the public. It's just for the Hollywood people. It's a logical next step for the Blacklist.
Yeah, Leonard Franklin has been a guest here on the show, so congratulations to him for taking it a step further.
It's a big deal for him.
Yes, that's right. Hi-ho, Silver! It's official! The Lone Ranger movie is back on with Johnny Depp starring as Tonto. Disney has even set a release date for the film, May 31st, 2013, a post-memorial opening that has caused the studio to play a shell game with some of its other releases. Thor 2, for instance, was pushed from summer 2013 into November to make way for Phineas and Ferb on July 26, 2013. Meanwhile, the Lone Ranger's budget has dropped from $250 million to $215 million, meaning...
Woo, finally, trim that sucker down to the bone.
Yeah, well, it means that Depp won't be collecting his usual $20 million paycheck, nor will producer Jerry Bruckheimer and director Gore Verbinski earn their $10 million asking price. I can honestly say, I speak for both Michael and I, you know, we feel their pain. Kimo Sabi, is this news that the Lone Ranger is back in production a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big... whoop. You know, it's yet another property that would have gotten made eventually. They may not get their money up front, but they'll get it on the back end.
As if it wasn't bad enough that the Iranian government was allegedly planning on assassinating a Saudi ambassador in the United States, they have now sentenced Iranian actress Marzia Vafamehr. I can't pronounce her last name, so I apologize. She has been sentenced to 90 lashes and a year in prison for not wearing a headscarf in the 2009 film My Tehran for Sale. The Australian film was never meant to be shown in Iran, but made its way there through the black market. The actress's family has declined assistance from the movie's producers, saying they just want Vafamehr's case to go through the normal legal channels. In other Iranian news, director Jafar Panahi has lost an appeal and remains sentenced to 6 years in prison and a 20-year ban on making movies for alleged crimes against the state. Michael, big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a very big deal. From my reading of, you know, seafaring novels set in the 1800s, 90 lashes is incredibly a huge amount of lashes. That can kill a person.
No, it'll leave scars. I mean,
well, it will certainly leave scars, unquestionably, for life. But I mean, in those days, when I read like Horatio Hornblow, if you sentence someone to 100 lashes, you're almost sentencing them to death. I assume that's not the case here, but this is not symbolic or anything. It's, you know, it's a country that's, you know, a religious state, and people do not have basic freedoms, and it's a terrible, terrible shame.
Yeah, I mean, when Samira Makhmalbaf comes to Cannes to show some of her films, she always wears this headscarf. And I thought, well, you know, why does she keep wearing that? I mean, she's not in Iran. Why? And I was told once, actually, she told me, she said, look, if I'm photographed here, I can't be photographed and then go back to Iran. I will be, you know, it's like a death sentence if I do that. Well,
she'll be in big trouble, that's for sure.
Yeah. Now imagine the punishment Christopher Chaney would receive if he lived in Iran. He's the 35-year-old man who allegedly hacked into the personal voicemail and email of Hollywood starlets, including Scarlett Johansson, Christina Aguilera, Mila Kunis, and up to 50 others. And this is a quote from him. It started as curiosity, and it turned out to just be addictive, said the Florida resident of the curiosity he just couldn't stop. Chaney would search the internet for celebrities' personal information, like their favorite pet or mother's maiden name, and then he would see if those were their passwords on their email accounts or their, say, voicemail. He would then hack into a star's email account and forward their email to himself. Chaney was arrested last week by the FBI and faces up to 121 years in prison, but no lashes from a whip if found guilty. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big whoop in the scheme of things. Everybody change your password. Don't make it something like your mother's maiden name. That's frightening to think how easy it was for him to hack into them. He doesn't seem to be any particular, computer whiz. He just did sort of basic stuff. Just looked at their basic information and was able to guess what their email password would be. It's amazing. But, it shows you what a bizarre life you lead when you look at celebs and see the bodyguards that they have and the world that they live in. You think how, you know, well, why would they do that? You know what? There's a lot of odd people out there.
Yeah, when I take my daughter to kindergarten, there's, you know, Jennifer Lopez's bodyguard standing outside. And she's dropping off the kids. It's just weird to see them there.
Yeah, you get used to it eventually, I assume.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. It's been 25 years since Paul Simon released the landmark album Graceland, one of the crowning achievements of his career and a single work in the explosion in popularity of world music throughout the West. He's going to celebrate it in grand style with an elaborate box set, a new feature-length documentary film about the political and musical controversy surrounding the album, and best of all, a tour reuniting Simon with the many artists who played on it, including Ladysmith Black Mombasa. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
That's a big deal to me. I love Paul Simon. It's a great, great album. Almost every artist involved in that album is still alive except for Miriam Makeba. So I saw the tour when they toured with the Graceland tour back in the
80s. And 1986.
I think it came to like Atlanta in 87 when I actually saw it, but I can't wait to see them again.
Yeah. I mean, look, Michael, you can always call me Al. Okay.
Do you know the story behind that song?
I know that Chevy Chase is in the video.
Very quickly, Paul Simon finally explained the story of what the song meant. And I had a friend who had this elaborate theory that you can call me Al. Al was short for Abraham Lincoln. And he explained how the song was about whatever. Completely untrue. Paul Simon explained that when he was dating Carrie Fisher, they had a dinner party with a number of people and one guy that they didn't really know. And they were all there at night. At the end of the night, the guy was leaving and he said, he was shaking hands with them. And he said, it was really nice meeting you. It was really nice meeting you, Al. Really nice meeting you, Betty. I really had a great time. It was good meeting you. I'll talk to you guys later. They're like, he called them Al and Betty. And they were like, they're world famous. And they were like, what the hell? So that became their like joke name for each other. She would call him Al. He would call her Betty. And ultimately he used it in the song. It's just complete nonsense from this guy who went to dinner at Paul Simon's house and had no idea who he was.
That's actually kind of funny.
Isn't that bizarre? Hey, it's really great meeting you, Al.
Glee's Ryan Murphy has just sold another show. His drama American Horror Story is on FX and reaching 2.4 million viewers. Now he's sold a single-camera sitcom about a gay couple and the woman who serves as a surrogate mother for their baby to NBC. Well, I think that may have been written wrong. I don't think she serves as a surrogate mother for NBC, but, well, you know. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big deal in a negative way. He's got Glee. That show had a very weak second season, and I don't understand people who have a hit show that also has creative sort of, you know, mojo going for it, and then spread themselves thin with three or four other projects. Focus on the show you have. Make it as great a show as you can. There will be plenty of opportunities when that show has run its course. Glee is so complex and difficult. Why would you want to do 17 other things poorly? Because Glee, frankly, fell off the rails a bit last season. Get it back on track. Stop doing all these other outside projects. Frankly, I would try and get a clause in saying, you know what? Don't do other shows when we're backing your show for, you know, tens and hundreds of millions of dollars to make the show a hit, and you're like off doing other stuff. I don't get it.
Well, yeah, but you can't. I mean, that's then fine. Pay me more. That's what he would turn around and say. You know, in other words, you know, I have the opportunity to do three shows and make X. You're saying no, do one show and make Y, which is much less. So therefore,
but you're damaging our show by spreading yourself and not focusing on it. You know, we pay you to create and do the show, and you're off doing two other shows for two other networks. I'd be very unhappy. I know nobody has ever made a contract like that, but you get paid very, very well to make a show, and you know this is, you know, spawned dozens of hit singles. It's a huge phenomenon, and he's letting it just go adrift, and I think it's a bad idea.
This story I found interesting. Actor Alec Baldwin has said he wants out of the sitcom 30 Rock in the not-too-distant future, and now we know what he might be doing afterwards. And I think he got this idea from us, Michael, by the way. New York's public radio station WNYC announced that Baldwin would be hosting a podcast called Here's the Thing for that station. Baldwin will, quote-unquote, pursue his passions and interests, end-quote, through conversations, apparently not interviews, just conversations, with an array of newsmakers, artists, actors, writers, and various public figures. So far, he's lined up Michael Douglas, Erica Jong, Chris Rock, Dick Cavett, and about, I don't know, 20 others, for he's going to produce 20 episodes. Don't expect him to make a career out of it, however, because despite his previous statements to the contrary, it looks as if Baldwin will stick around 30 Rock probably for another year or two. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, I don't think 30 Rock should be done in another year or two, but hey, that's just my opinion. It's a big whoop, of course. It's not what he's doing instead of 30 Rock. It's not a podcast of 20 episodes. It's not a commitment like that. It starts on October 24th. I don't know if we mentioned that, but that's when you can find the debut podcast. This infuriates me, though. He and Elvis Costello and all these people and Daryl Hall, come on, I'm trying to get some work here. You know, there's things are drying up for us freelancers, and you stars who already have careers are double downing and taking away jobs from us journalists. Stop it. Stop it, I say.
I agree. Gosh darn it.
It's like the Interview Magazine, the Andy Warhol's Interview Magazine. That was always such a nightmare. We'll get celebrities to interview celebrities. We'll eliminate the journalists completely. But, you know, more power to him. He also hosts the New York Philharmonic this week on radio. So he's been a guest host on Kurt Anderson's show, Studio 360. So, you know, he's done a lot of radio, and he's a, you know, he's an interesting guy. I'm sure he'd have interesting conversations.
That's true. I would also like to say he is my classmate from NYU. He graduated the same year I did, despite the fact that he was about 12 years my senior.
Yeah, I was about to say. Okay.
Universal chickens out on its premium video on demand experiment with the Ben Stiller, Eddie Murphy comedy Tower Heist. Numerous theater chains threatened to boycott the movie until the studio finally said it would pull the plug on plans to make the film available for premium video on demand at $60, just 3 weeks after the film debuted. And right during the Thanksgiving holidays, by the way. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal. Obviously, they listened when their stars got very, very angry. What I found interesting was that, according to an analyst in Variety, video on demand accounts for 10% of a studio's domestic gross. So if you gross $100 million, they estimate you'll gross another $10 million on video on demand. You know, so it's starting to make up for what DVD is losing. DVD used to make 100% of your box office gross or more. Now it's down to 60%. Video on demand now grosses, you know, another 10% of that box office gross. Some companies like Lionsgate say video on demand accounts for like 25% of its revenue because it's so cheap to do. They don't have to make DVDs. It's 35% of their profits at Lionsgate. So clearly video on demand is growing and growing, but they went too far and too fast with this. So that's all video on demand after a movie's out of theaters and after it's on DVD and all that. This is while it's in theaters and everybody freaked out and got angry at them because it's just building up into a good business and now they're screwing the supply chain by doing this. And it was a very dangerous thing that people are angry about.
Right. Well, and here's the issue. You know, you had Cinemark in the United States and they have theaters all over the world. And you had National Amusements, two big chains in the U.S., and they said they weren't going to show it. That accounted for about 12% of the 39,000 screens in North America. And so if that kind of translated to even a one-to-one ratio to box office, you're talking about a 12% drop in box office.
Potential box office.
And if for a film that is kind of tracking to do about $100 million, that could be $10 or $12 million. So I don't know that Universal could take that, especially if you have people like Ben Stiller, Eddie Murphy, and director Brett Ratner, who are, you know, profit participants. They're not going to be happy. Their representatives aren't going to be happy. So, you know, Universal was the one having to field all these calls while they had their parent company, Comcast, trying to push this idea. And maybe the executives at Universal said, you know what, Comcast, you want to do this? Fine, we'll do this. Now watch what happens. And they just let it go. But I will say, you know, there was some comment about the fact that exhibitors went quote unquote nuclear on this, that they just, you know, said, all right, we won't show it at all.
Mm-hmm.
But the reality is when you give somebody like exhibitors or in any business where you're trying to buttress one half of a business by taking money out of the pocket of the other half, it never works. You can't do that. It just, the other half will never allow it to happen. You're threatening the other half. And exhibitors knew, okay, fine, if we allow this to happen, it'll be $60 and 3 weeks for a while.
But and then it'll be $40, $20.
Right.
And it'll be day and date.
Exactly.
just like it is with small indie films a lot of times.
Exactly. So they said, we can't give an inch on this. And our only option, our back is against the wall. And our only option, since effectively what you're saying is, if we allow this to happen, it will ultimately be day and date and it would mean our demise. Our only option is to bring you down with us or to prove to you what your how adverse your actions will be to yourself.
Exactly, which is the same reason why the bookstore chains pulled all the DC comic books from their shelves. They said, you want to make an exclusive digital deal with Amazon? Fine, we're not carrying your books.
Yeah, I mean, think about it. For Cinemark or for National Amusements, if it's $12 million in box office that's going to be gone, that means $6 million to these exhibitors. They were putting their money where their mouth was.
That's true.
That's right. Netflix just signed an 8-year deal with the CW network worth some $1 billion. Here's the skinny. Netflix can stream all episodes of any show that currently are on the air. Netflix can stream all episodes of any show that debuts by 2015, but not right away. Netflix must wait till the season is over, and no library of past shows like Gilmore Girls. It's unclear if that means they get the entire library of Gossip Girl. For their sake, we hope so. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, I think it's a big deal because it seems like such a bad deal. It just seems wildly overpriced. The CW is barely a network right now. It has 13 shows in this fall and spring. Only one of them is ranked in the top 100, and that's The Vampire Diaries, which is ranked at number 99. It's barely in the top 100. There's only about 120 shows on the air. Almost all the bottom 20 are CW shows. Almost Vampire Diaries is the only show that reaches more than 2 million viewers a week on air, barely. All the others are below 2 million viewers. I mean, their fall schedules are not a success even by the low standards of CW. Why would you pay $1 billion for those 13 shows and a hoped-for hit or two in the next two or three seasons? I mean, basically, if Gossip Girl, One Tree Hill, The Vampire Diaries, America's Next Top Models, and Supernatural, and then you've got current stuff that's not great, like 90210, Ringer, Secret Circle, Nikita, and so on. I mean, what are reruns of America's Next Top Model worth? Who wants to stream that?
You know,
that?
Actually, if I could make a good snoring noise, now would be right about the time I'd...
Sorry. But I mean, really... you know, reruns of shows and you have to wait till the season is over? It just seems a bad deal on every level.
Rosie O'Donnell's new talk show on Oprah's new channel, OWN, scored bigger ratings than even Oprah. O'Donnell drew 497,000 viewers and a total of 1.5 million people over multiple airings. Oprah's Life Lessons drew 330,000, or 1.2 million total. But wait, after 3 days, Rosie keeps tumbling and is down to 254,000 viewers, while Oprah's show builds on that to 338,000 viewers Now who's laughing? Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Big deal. Oprah seems to be the only thing that works on her network right now. So it's, you know, they're still trying to find the right mix of shows. Rosie O'Donnell was a good bet. Hopefully they'll be patient and she'll start to draw a better audience, but it's not a good start.
Hulu is no longer for sale. No one could figure out what exactly they'd been buying, since if Hulu was sold, the company's contributing TV shows, namely Disney, ABC, Fox, and others, would immediately have an incentive to take their shows elsewhere for more money. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Big deal. We've always thought Hulu would last for a while and then just sort of fall apart on its own. Selling it made no sense from the moment it was announced, so we're not surprised that it ended.
Yeah, I mean, really what this is saying is we didn't get the price we wanted.
Yeah, but they couldn't because there was nothing to buy.
Yeah, exactly. You're buying technology, which you could probably build yourself for relatively inexpensively. And the content, well, that's ours and we could take it away at any time. Now, I guess, you know, since this news happened, there's, you know, a little related moment here or related piece of news. And that is that apparently Hulu's owners are now thinking about pursuing an IPO for the site.
Yeah. Good idea.
Yeah, well, it can raise some cash and they could go after Netflix, I suppose. Who knows? Well, that concludes Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us right along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. Now, this week, we're going to be talking about publishing. And Amazon had some big news. Well, I don't know if it was news. I don't know how this story became so big, but they continue to push into publishing. It has a sci-fi fantasy horror imprint now, with input from the likes of top writers like Neal Stephenson and Greg Bear, and it snagged the hotly contested memoir of actress and director Penny Marshall, beating out every other traditional publisher, even though it's unclear if top chains will carry a book published by Amazon. The book is due out in fall of 2012, and a key reason Amazon won, according to Marshall's people, is it offered a much better ebook rate than the standard 25% most publishers try to offer. What do you make of all this, Michael? I know you know a lot about the publishing industry.
Well, it's fascinating. Let's put it in context. I don't remember when Barnes & Noble started their publishing line, but they basically published classic novels that are in the public domain, like David Copperfield, you know, Charles Dickens and Mark Twain, stuff like that. Everybody freaked when they did that, published their own public domain titles, because they're competing directly with Penguin and all the other lines that publishers have where they reprint public domain titles of famous authors and make money off of it. And for Amazon to start doing that really upset them. We're talking about public domain titles that have been out there for like 100 years. And that upset them. They didn't know what to do. How would they handle it? Would no other store would carry the titles? Of course. Why would they? It just freaked everybody out. And they're like, this is it. This is all we're doing. We're not competing with you. We just want to do this one little thing. Amazon, in contrast, is doing everything a publisher does. Not only are they signing up hot new authors and publishing imprints and actually publishing brand new fiction and memoirs, but they're competing to sign authors. They're offering backroom services that publishers and agents used to offer. They're letting people self-publish more easily than ever. I mean, they are pushing themselves into every possible avenue of publishing, and they're in the number one bookstore in the country. You know, they're online. They're it, baby. They're by far dominant online. They dominate the ebook. They are taking over the industry in a way that iTunes never did. I mean, Apple never signed up music stars and started releasing albums. That's the equivalent of what we're talking about. If iTunes dominated the selling of digital music and started to sign up big acts, that's the equivalent here.
Don't you think that the reason, you know, iTunes never really got into that is they didn't want to compete with the labels that they were asking for music from?
Well, but they became so dumb that they could have done it if they wanted to. Amazon's proving that. They're competing with the labels that they get their books from. You know, the book publishers could say, you know what? We're not going to put our books on Amazon anymore. Really? Try that. We're not going to sell it on Kindle anymore. Good idea. See how that works. You know, they're so dominant, just like iTunes was, and they are pushing in ways iTunes never even dreamt of into every facet of publishing. I mean, they're competing with Random House, Simon & Schuster on a very direct, big level. And they're competing with agents and managers by offering backroom services and self-publishing and everything you can think of. They are literally becoming a scary, scary monster in the publishing world.
Well, Russell Grandinetti, who is one of Amazon's top executives, said, "It's always the end of the world." And he was referring to publishers. "You could set your watch on it arriving. The only really necessary people in the publishing process now are the writer and reader. Everyone who stands between those two has both risk and opportunity."
Well, he's right, especially if you're a writer who already has a big fan base like Stephen King or J.K. Rowling. They could obviously set up their own website, sell books directly, and be fine. It's a pain in the neck a little bit, perhaps, but they can do it, and some are doing it. But, you know, when you're Random House and you've been around for 100 years or whatever, you see Amazon as a threat. And to say, oh, well, that's okay, everybody's at risk. Well, yeah, but you're selling our books, and now you're competing directly with us to sign authors, and that's a very scary situation for a lot of publishers.
We actually do have some listener email for this week. Our first email is from CJ Flynn, who we actually read an email from him last week. This one is much shorter. And it says, hey, guys, he's referring to Tintin, by the way, in this email. He says, I'm going to record a bunch of French people saying the name of their childhood hero. Until I do, please do not say it the way you have been. Unfortunately, we've done it how many times during this show? Or is that the way they officially – is that the official pronunciation in the Americas? C.J. Flynn, D-Cinema.
It's Tonton, and everybody in America probably says Tintin because that's how it looks when you spell it. And we never – we don't live with Tintin. At most, we might have looked at the comic books. We haven't seen the TV shows. People don't talk about it, so nobody ever says the name. So we never hear it pronounced Tonton.
Right.
So that's – we apologize. We'll have to try and remember that. I've learned that before, but you keep forgetting because it just is not in our cultural – DNA the way so many other characters are.
Now, our next email comes from Andrew Einsbrook. You want to read this?
Sure. He says, hey, guys, thought you might be interested in this article on 4D cinema that appeared in the Sydney Morning Herald. Given how down Michael is on 3D cinema, I can't imagine he'll think much of paying, as the article states, twice the normal ticket price to see Avatar in 4D. Keep up the good work. Cheers, Andrew. And when you click on the link that's in our show notes, you'll find that 4D is basically the old gimmick of like sense around that they did in the 70s, where like if you went to see the movie Earthquake, it would slightly shake your seat during the earthquake sequence to give you that exciting thrill of actually being in an earthquake. So it's just, you know, a total ridiculous gimmick. It's absurd beyond belief. And anyone who pays twice the ticket price to see it is crazy. But thanks for pointing it out to us. I hadn't heard about it.
Now, you're not crazy for listening to our show and emailing us the way Andrew and CJ did. Our email address is dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can send us a voicemail or leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can follow us on Twitter. Our username is showbizsandbox. And on Facebook, our page can be found. Just search for Showbiz Sandbox. Now, all of this information, as well as links to all of the stories we discussed on today's show, they're at our website, showbizsandbox.com. I know this is really hard for you to kind of maybe write down. Showbiz Sandbox. So everything happens to revolve around it. Showbizsandbox.com. The usernames are Showbiz Sandbox. You know, pretty simple. It's so simple, you could go over to the iTunes store and search for Showbiz Sandbox and subscribe to our show there, or even rate and review it. The same thing at the Zune Marketplace or now Stitcher.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, who is MGMT.com. And on November 10th and 11th, they can be found at the Guggenheim Museum in New York. They are doing two shows there for a, I guess, one of the museum's retrospectives for artist Maurizio Cattelan, whose work will encircle the band as they perform, exhibited throughout the spiral-shaped building.
Okay.
Now, a little programming note, we will be off next week. So next week, there will be no show. We will return the week after. Michael, in the meantime, his work can be found at michaelgiltz.com. Some of my writing on the industry can be found at celluloidjunkie.com. Until 2 weeks from now, play nice.